So the next item up on the list is, my name is Walter Petruska. I'm the Information Security, Privacy, and Compliance Officer for the University of San Francisco. And it's my pleasure to be presenting to you the topic of how university online and backup is moving online. For those of you who aren't aware, this is my next shameless plug being the security guy, right? October is National Cybersecurity Awareness Month. So see, there's a tie-in, Halloween candy, October, kind of Halloween colors here. Other than a shameless plug for National Cybersecurity Awareness Month, one of the key components of this program through Stay Safe Online, through the FTC, through a lot of information security councils, such as the Higher Education Information Security Council, we have programs called like Stop, Think, Click and Stop, Think, Connect that are designed for home users, for all of you as regular people out on the street, and as community members in higher education that's aimed with materials towards students. At USF, we're having an information fair, information security fair on the 26th. We have a poster contest that goes on, lots of things. And one of the core supporting concepts to make it really easy for people that all these different programs have adhered to are seven simple steps. And you'll see a lot of this in your own campuses from your security people, I'm sure, I hope. Brochures and items online in campaigns that talk about seven practices for computer security. How this all relates to the topic at hand is, if you look here at number six, it says backup important files and learn what to do in an emergency. That's kind of clever. But number six didn't used to be there always. And number six, if you look at traditional advice on what to do to back up important files, what would most people do or what would most literature say traditionally over the years? Oh, back up your files to something, right? Burn it to a CD. And then hopefully you put the CD somewhere, not in your computer laptop bag with the laptop that gets stolen, right? Or put it on a thumb drive and hope that you have enough capacity on your thumb drive to cover what you need. But this is a critical part of information security. It's being taught in K through 12. We're pushing this out at universities, and it's just really wise advice. And it's something that often gets overlooked. You know, we talk about password security, obviously, you know, keeping your computer up to date with patches and antivirus, but people more often than not forget about backing up important files. So here's an overview, topics we're going to cover, changes in needs, changes in opportunities, data explosion. The rest of it you can read. This is a very similar presentation to ones that I've given at Educom, Campus Technology, and Regional Educause, but it's been updated each time because about every 6 months there's something different, both in the marketplace and about what USF's experience has been in using online backup. So I'll try to cover those things as quickly as possible and get to a point where we can take questions. So along with changing needs, we started the undertaking of doing something about laptop and desktop end user backup, file backup, in 2007. And the original reasons for that, I'm going to get into, you know, what the drivers are. But the first thing that really precipitated that is having to encrypt everyone's hard drives because, especially in California, we had the California Database Breach Notification Act that says, you know, anything that isn't encrypted that's private data, you can be liable for in civil and criminal matters, et cetera. So we really had to do something because we didn't know what data people had. Trying to get people in a university community to all do the right thing is difficult. Sometimes even the faculty who are the computer science professors are the hardest ones to get to change their ways. But we were going to encrypt things, and everyone was afraid of encryption, and it's going to ruin the hard drive, I'll lose my data, whatever. So we took advantage of that opportunity to look at doing something the way of backup. But again, changing needs since that time, it's a more mobile community population. That's nothing new to any of you, I'm sure. The devices themselves are more portable, so our user communities are more distance learners, people who are getting around a little bit more. The devices are a lot of times mobile devices, very thin clients. Increasing demand to find cost-effective solutions, part of our recession environment. fewer staff, also part of, you know, the current economic situation. And as far as changing opportunities, there's quickly developing SaaS and cloud-based services, which people can now take advantage of. The maturity may not have been there in the past, but it's quickly coming there. So some of this information, this digital content created, you know, even during tough times, right, our data sets continue to grow. If for no other reasons, we have more snapshots of data for our ERP data, our systems data, there's more log data. Over time, you're just going to have more data. Not to mention the fact that actual content is the rate of growth is increasing. If you look at these forecasts from IDC, in 2006, you had 161 exabytes. In 2010, the forecast was for growth to 988 exabytes. Already in 2009, or in 2008, it was 3% higher projection on this original pathway. The 2009 number is 6%. So even the, you know, if you look, the projection is getting further and further behind. So suffice it to say, it's fair to assume that in 2010, we're going to exceed the 1,000 exabytes of data, which is pretty unimaginable. If you look at where some of this data comes from, you'll find that 70% of it is created by individuals, and that's pretty much true even on our campuses, right? If you look at all devices end-to-end in the data center, the servers, desktops, laptops, mobile computing, most of the content itself is from the end users. There's lots of institutional data and metadata, but it's papers, right? It's new curriculum being created. It's emails, things that are actually created by individuals. However, 85%, it's the responsibility of organizations to ensure information security, privacy, reliability, compliance, right? A greater compliance edict, tougher laws. And if you look and think about the data or the access to a network, anything on campus, rarely is it the individual who takes the blame when there's a network outage or someone can't get on wireless. It's never the end user's fault, right? It's that darn network, or why do you have NAC on my wireless? Why can't I get on? Why is the network so slow, et cetera? So again, if you look at all that data that's being created, about 85% of it, it's the institutional's responsibility generally to safeguard and secure that data, right? When faculty are doing something and it's on a university-owned laptop and it fails, whether it's the hard drive or something else, it's the institution's responsibility to try and help them get that back. So the backup imperative, really quickly, here's, you know, the difference between reality and assumptions. You know, what are the causes of data loss? This is from OnTrack Data Recovery. There's the customer perceptions, and most of these are pretty clear, but some are a little bit off. That hardware system failure. Oh, it's my hardware. It's going to fail. Generally, most of us are not buying hardware for laptops, desktops, et cetera, that are not much more reliable when it comes to the hard drive in the lifetime expectancy or the drive failures as it was many years ago. So the actual findings are kind of shrinking there. But in the area where you see it's growing, and in fact I would say that from my experience, this next category is actually larger than that. Human error. One thing that's not covered on here that really should be, that I'm always interested in, is loss and theft. Because that seems to be the one that pops up. It's the sore thumb. You know, people kind of expect a hard drive to die, but when someone's computer gets stolen, alarm bells go off, and it's kind of a crisis. And that's not even on here. But if you look at it traditionally, again, it's not really viruses are very, very low. People always assume, oh, a virus, you know, is going to ruin my hard drive. No one writes viruses to do something malicious without making some money off of it anymore. So for the most part, your viruses are silently just stealing your data. They're not actually going to crash your hard drive. So I'm not sure if that's better or worse. The cost of recovering a drive can exceed $7,500. I don't know if you all knew that, but when we send a hard drive out, if for some reason for a forensic examination or if there's something absolutely critical, right, a trustee's data is on the president of the university's laptop drive died and you can't get things off and there is no other copy, what do? When you send it out to drive savers or disk doctors or something, it's going to be anywhere in the $2,800 to up to $7,500 range if you send it out to a professional to recover that data. If you aren't able to recover the data, what was the cost of the data that was on there, and how long is it going to take in man-hour terms to recreate that, especially when you're dealing with institutional research data that may be the only place it was? There could be additional liabilities, right? The federal government, they paid for that research. They want their data. At USF, what we've observed is on an annual basis, 7% of users will need to recover data using the tools that we've given them. And this is end-user data, not institutional data, but that's from their personal computers. And 2.5% or so per year need a full recovery, where something happened and everything they have is gone, and they come in kind of freaking out and running around in circles saying, help me, help me. So it's kind of nice. It's, I hope, for the right 2.5% per year. It's a good time to rack up some favors. Traditionally, in the past, we use in-house managed backup. These are just kind of points for you to be thinking about your own institution in the whole purpose of this presentation. What are you doing traditionally? What are you doing today? What are your hardware and software costs, the data center overhead, storage capacity planning? Those of you who aren't on the technical side of it, you have no idea of how hard that really is. If you don't know, put something in and visit it a year, 2 or 3 years later, and you'll find out you never got to 2 years later before you've exceeded all of your capacity planning projections, that somehow your data has gone off in a corner and multiplied. Maintenance and support costs is nothing new to any of us. Even in higher education, we still pay a pretty big premium on support. Tape and offsite rotation costs is really, it's not an industry best practice anymore. A lot of you who are going to get audits, you'll find that your audit teams coming in will actually tell you it's really time to start moving away from that tape-based solution, from doing offsite tape rotations, because of cost, reliability, the ability for people to come in and actually do test restores on that to see if your backup program is actually working or not. And then, of course, security costs nowadays. We have to actually think about safeguarding that data. So that is the background. Here's a little bit about University of San Francisco. We are now, oops, I didn't update our enrollment on this. Our enrollment hasn't changed all that much. It's about 9,000 students. There's six colleges within the university, about 1,300 faculty staff, about 720 of those, 720, 750 are full-time. The number has shrunk, like everywhere else, I think, on some full-time staff faculty. But if you look at the total university community through foundations and institutes that we have on campus, it's about 12,000 people with 58 FTEs on the IT staff. So what were the business drivers that brought us to what this presentation is about today, which is moving backup of file systems for end-user systems online? There's three principal business drivers. One was information security. That's intellectual property protection. Again, the research data or the information that you have in curriculum, that type of material, you really have to safeguard that these days. Theft. It does happen as more and more users, despite what we would want, we want to give them a low-cost PC in the office, and for security, I'd love to have it chained to a wall and they can't do anything with it or super glued to the floor. Unfortunately, that's not the trend. The trend really is, now that laptop, mobile device prices have come down, more and more people are actually really kind of insisting on or getting that mobile device. So with that, theft is actually going up. Privacy and safeguards through laws. If data is lost, under many state laws now, right, we have an obligation to notify. This was very frustrating in 2007 for me to commit to leadership that every time a laptop was stolen, I had to, you know, tell the institution and general counsel, well, what data was on it? Whose data was on it? Whose data was on it that we have to notify? Where's the list? Well, it's gone, you know. So unfortunately, the way the law is written, and many more of the laws are being written, you have to assume the worst. So if that person had access to my ERP system, right, and had Social Security number access, everything else, institution-wide, worst case, the obligation would be that I have to print this, I have to make a public notice, I have to send notices to every student, staff, faculty that could potentially have had their information breached. Certainly, general counsel and everyone said, no, that's really not good. So one of the benefits here is, as an information security officer, all those backups, even if the device were lost, I can actually recover it, look at the recovery set, pull it out of the cloud, dig through that data, and find out whose information was on it, or characterize what information was on it. And because I actually am doing that with real data, when I attest to the fact that here's the only information that was on it, there is nothing sensitive on it. Oh, and by the way, I have the backup set. General counsel loves that because they're like, ah, we can prove that there is nothing on it, we don't have to do anything, we're good to go, just go buy a new laptop. Right? Off and running. So that's a really big thing. Moving down to some of the other areas, you know, business continuity, DRP. I hate talking about where we're located sometimes, but we are only about 3 miles from the San Andreas Fault. And I don't know if many of you know, but San Francisco did burn once. The University of San Francisco is actually at its fourth location. Hopefully it's our last location, but it's partly because if any of you have been in San Francisco, you know, there's the Civic Center Plaza. It's very pretty, big open space. That was actually, that whole quad area was our old campus. And when all the buildings were demolished after the last earthquake, we moved out further to where no man's land was. But I bring that up because it's happened before. And we have to be thinking about, those of us who are risk managers, is that things like that could happen again. How do I keep the institution up and running? Well, with technology, if I have a more mobile workforce, I have more staff and faculty who are doing distance learning, they have laptops, you know, et cetera, and I have their information somewhere kept safe in the cloud far away from San Francisco, and I give them easy-to-use tools that you'll see to retrieve that data, they can actually get to their PowerPoint presentations. They can get to their video recordings of lecture capture, et cetera. And you know what? It's going to be hard, but as long as they can get some network connectivity or get students together in some other location, they can do what our mission is, and that is they can continue to teach, right? So ERP systems, that's great. I have a hot site somewhere. It takes time to recover, but we can keep the institution alive. But if we can't do what the mission is, and that's teaching, none of us, at least without a huge endowment, which USF does not have, we can't survive. Okay, we could survive 9 months to 11 months, I think, if we really didn't have any billable curriculum. And I think that's true for a lot of you. So again, those were the requirements, and a valuable service for end users, especially when people realize that, oops, right, you saw human error, 11 to 12%, sometimes up to 20%, I would say, of the data loss is our human error. I deleted the wrong thing, help, it's my term paper, or professors who say, help, I accidentally deleted all the papers I've already graded. I'd like them back. Grades are due tomorrow. Pre-existing environment, real quickly, we had 6 known independent solutions for backing up end user laptop departmental files. I'll just let you read through this. Basically, no two were the same. And those were the 6 known, right? So when I started going around doing a survey, 6 different colleges, 5 different campuses, you can imagine what I found. Either people weren't doing anything, or they didn't know what they were doing, or they were doing it, but they didn't know how often they were doing it, and trust me, none of them had ever done a trial recovery of their data. The trials were, oops, when something's lost, we try to recover it. That's their trial. And almost all the solutions required a skilled sysadmin, right? So if it's, whether it was backup exec or many of the other programs, you generally have a system administrator in there somewhere. One of the other ones, all but one required network connectivity, in that if you're an adjunct, if you're assigned staff off network, right, you're doing your work in Starbucks, you're at the EDUCAUSE conference, and you're doing some work, believe it or not, while you're at a conference, you're actually doing institutional work, you're not on the network and you're not doing backups. A lot of them were as long as you're on the local LAN or people were mounting the Novell or SMB shares. And all of the legacy solutions kept the backups on campus. Again, not a great thing when the campus has been destroyed once in 100 years. I wouldn't want to count on it again. So our initial attempt, our central systems infrastructure group had purchased, installed, configured, and began a rollout of an enterprise-class desktop backup solution. At the end of this, you know, they had to buy two servers because it was, you know, availability, scalability, et cetera. You can see here basically the two bottom line numbers. The ones in red, not surprising. Spent a lot of capital, a lot of labor startup costs. And that was to get just the pilot up. The projection for doing up to 2,000 users, you can see in red what that was. I'm trying to do that now, and that was back in 2006. We had the money. We probably couldn't have even done that pilot now. At the end of it, after spending the money that we did, the 48,000, 26,000, so about 100,000, we ended up with really only 100 users actually on, because it's end user adoption. It's too hard. I don't understand. Why are you forcing this on me now? Why do you want to back up my data but not someone else's? You know, all the reasons why you can't get users to do something. And at the end, the high frustration level and costs just pretty much killed it. So we put on our thinking cap. We went out, and long story short, actually what we did, previous presentations I've given went into, you know, the whole process of the examination of doing an RFI, identifying vendors, bringing them in, doing the head-to-head kind of contestant results. At the end of it, a company called Mosey won. No one could actually believe that a company no one had ever heard of, compared to some other very big names, actually won on all counts, on the money, on the user acceptance, on the speed, et cetera. So we've had them in since May 2007. They're still here. Some of the product developments that they have that are more recent is the ability in Mosey Pro 2.0 to do local backups to removable media or network shares, as well as backing up into the cloud, which is really helpful for some people who have large data sets and they frequently want to access a historical record or an archive of older data, especially as their hard drives on a laptop are pretty full and they have to put their data somewhere and they don't know where to put it anymore. One of the great things about Mosey is once you've had a file somewhere, unless you've deleted it and it's 30 days later, every file and every version of every file down to the bit level is saved forever. It's a nice thing. Trust me, it's really nice when you can go back, now that we've had since 2007, and I can find things that are about that old and actually recover old versions of documents. Right now we're at about 980 licenses for end-user systems. Some of the shift has changed. By 2011, we'll be up to 1,300. We would have been over that by now, except we went for a year without replacing hardware last year because of the budget crisis type things. We extended the life of some old hardware, and it wasn't worth putting new things on old hardware. It does support Windows 7, 32, 64-bit, just about everything you can imagine. We're about one-third max at USF, so that was a really big thing for us. Again, one of the reasons they won is they had a Mac client as well as a PC client, and that the servers, desktop, laptop, Mac, PC, everything is one administration console. So the bottom line here, it used to be that our two-year cost savings was $202,000 or over 75%. Now it's $218,000 over 3 years or 80% based on what the former solution forecast for 2 years would have been, only because the former solution wouldn't have continued to scale after 2 years, right? Enterprise, you buy it, disk, SAN, everything else. After 2 years, you're probably going out. Yes? No, that's actually been for the 2000 to two. So for the period 2007 to 2009, that was total real expenditures.
Okay, thank
you. So and that's why it's there, because that way you're not comparing one that's moving and one that's stagnant. But it would have been the forecast for the full 2 years versus our actual. And part of that is, like anything else, the great thing with our particular choices, it's a pay-as-you-go model. So if there's only 10 users and 10 licenses that I've rolled out today, I'm only paying for 10. I only pay for the storage I'm using. So some of that is a ramp up, right? In the beginning, I could say my cost savings was 99.8% because I've only implemented this much. One of the great things about software as a service or a managed solution, you don't have to pay all the capital up front. But that's why I wanted to show 2 and 3 year numbers, because in the short term, it's really deceptive. Yes? Yes and no. Yes, if it's unique and not used and the user hasn't deleted it. So it's still on their hard drive. They have something that's very old, but they've chosen not to delete it themselves. See, I can't make that choice for them. I would like to institutionally, but as soon as I do, I can look at my watch and count the minutes before someone's going to say, why did you get rid of this very valuable spreadsheet I made of student grades from 2002, and I'll hear about it. So as long as they don't delete it, I don't delete it. So it is still there in that case. However, multiple versions of that same file really aren't counting against my quota. I mean, there's some fuzzy logic that goes into it. So you can have, if you have multiple versions of the same document, it's really not counting against, you know, I'm not paying for those, because they're copying just the bit level changes. So for them, as long as you have the latest version or the earliest version, the storage is really the earliest version, whatever the file size is, plus some very small incremental changes for versions over time. So you don't pay for those. Okay. So just some quick information. Mozy Pro is part of EMC. They weren't when we went with them. They had, I think, 41 employees. Based in Utah with one office and one data center, so it was kind of a stretch originally. It was nice to see a few months after we started implementing that EMC came in, scooped them up, made them part of the happy EMC family, and fed them well, and they now have data centers in, I'm going to get this wrong, five data centers worldwide. So in, I'm not sure if the, is China open now? Yeah, so they have data centers worldwide that EMC has funded. It's all EMC enterprise class stuff behind the curtain. And this is a security paranoid one. That was one of the things about where's all this data going and is it secure. So I did my own testing, and I'm a perfectionist, so if it got past me, it must be pretty good. Just again, how it looks, you know, just hitting the cloud and it goes to the data center. Data is written to multiple data centers over time. The data centers within Mozy back each other up. So my data is somewhere else. I'm not paying a premium selecting multiple data centers. They're kind of striping their data throughout their data centers worldwide. The Mozy Pro client, this is something that's new. It was simple enough to use the first time around that it won the competition against some of the other enterprise class solutions for, from the end users, but now it's gotten even easier. From my standpoint, it's too easy, right? I have the easy button there, start backup. There's not much else for a user to do, really. It's like, if what do you want to do? Everything's automatic, it's policy driven, but if you want to back up the whole thing right now, there's a start backup button, which then becomes pause once it's running, and it gives you an idea of how things went. If you notice, this I just grabbed from my laptop last night. It says, last local backup failed, and I can get details. That's because I actually have mindset to do both, backup to the cloud and local, right? So removable media, one of the things that I do, because I have a lot of really big file sets for virtual machines on my MacBook with VMware. So my external drive is collecting all the snapshots and rollbacks from my virtual machines. Much easier to try and recover those from local media than it is trying to pull that out of a cloud. So that's what that failure was. But it's really pretty easy. As far as what users get to see, it's really intuitive. It follows, you know, kind of the modern design for usability. There's the little welcome screen there with the smiley face that would tell them, welcome, this is what this application is used for. Here's who to contact when they click help or something. That actually, all the help is context sensitive, and I can edit, you know, when there's FAQs or error messages, I can edit the message for my enterprise. So it's not a generic message that has to do with the software. It can tell them contact the ITS help desk or call someone who cares, whatever it is I want them to do. And then you have these little tabs across the top. There's backup sets, file systems, options, whatever. It's fairly easy. You just click in things, lots of little graphics. This would be an example of the backup sets. And one of the reasons I'm showing this is, you know, users, I don't know exactly maybe what they want to back up. But if I ask them, you know, what's important to you? Oh, they can tell you. Oh, my email's important. My PowerPoint presentations, my Word documents, whatever. So we have these pre-built backup sets that by rules, the user doesn't have to do anything when we push out the client or they get the client. My policies say look for these things, and if you find them wherever they're hidden in the hierarchy, go ahead and back them up. So I know PowerPoint presentations are pretty important. So the universal rule is if you find a bunch of PowerPoint presentations, grab them, back them up. The user may not remember where all they put them, but the system will go through and find them. And if you look down at the bottom, there are some red ones. Those are actually exclusion rules for policies that I have that the client, and this is off my laptop last night, and I even exclude things for myself. Email and contacts in Eudora. Eudora, many of you know, is it's a dead application now. It's not supported anymore. We've retired it. We're actually a Gmail shop. A Google Don's Apps is what we call it, et cetera. So along with that, we also said, well, you can't be using Eudora anymore as the client application to IMAP to Google. So for people who still had Eudora on their laptop and they have those mail archives in Eudora that go back to 1972 or something, and those of you who do support, you know what I mean, you'll look at some people's computers and say, oh my God, every email, they've never found the delete button. It's red, but they have never actually deleted an email and they continuously archive. So what I've done there is I don't care if you still have that. You are not backing that up, all right? Because there's also new institutional retention policies on data with e-discovery, federal law, right? So I have that now through an e-discovery tool with Google. We've been on them for over a year, so I can find every email ever going in or out. The users can recover any email in or out for a one-year period, even if they deleted it. So they don't need to be keeping these just mountains of emails because it's a liability. Somewhere in those emails, there's attachments or there's Visa, MasterCard, American Express, there's someone's Social Security number, there's just something toxic that I don't want them to keep anymore. Exclude large music and exclude video and movie clips. That was about 17% of my data usage after 2 years. So that's a relatively new rule about those of you who love Parks and Recreation or something like that. It's very nice, but you know, your downloaded entire third season of Desperate Housewives and stuff do not constitute data that I should be paying for you to safeguard in the cloud, nor your iTunes. So large music, things like that are absolutely, you know, your iTunes library, I'm sorry, I'm excluding that. But if you notice that one isn't locked, exclude large music. So those are the default ones as policies, but the end user, if you're a language teacher perhaps and you go, yeah, these are language tapes of, you know, Japanese to English translations, I need them for what I do, you can go ahead and choose those things. But the user would actually have to think about that. Restore options, client-based Windows Explorer or in Mac, you know, the multi-finger touch. You can do it right in the device itself, from the desktop or the folder view. You can grab any particular file, and you can have it show you versions or all versions, restore the last version, or show me how many different versions of this file I have, and it'll instantly pop up a little dialog box, and it'll give you the date and the time back to the day we started implementing this of every version you've ever had of that. So if someone decided they wanted the one from June of last year, like last year's PowerPoint presentation, they can easily just pull that out. Web restore is DVDs for really big restore sets are great, but the web restore feature is the most commonly used for end users, and that's because they can then restore their data to something that isn't their own. It's not their own computer. And that was part of our disaster recovery strategy. Again, if you know we have a big earthquake, a lot of people lose their hardware, whether it's desktop, laptop, whatever. The computer that they're going to get their hands on to keep teaching or working may not be an institutional one. It doesn't have the client already loaded on it. I don't have time to distribute software keys and encryption keys and everything. So they actually have a web interface just for their machine or machines that they can browse through the whole directory and recover files to wherever. So if they're at a conference, you're visiting your mother for Christmas, and you want to show her your great presentation or read a paper to her, you can log on to her very slow computer probably, if it's like my mother, and actually grab the files that you want and restore it right there. So that was a really big thing for us. And hard drive. So if you had really big data sets, we can always just either ship, or we have a good enough relationship, I think, and call people at Mosey and say, wow, that extra 1.5 terabytes of data, I'd love to pull it down from the cloud, but could you just FedEx it to me on a drive? The admin console, real quickly, it's one to many. So our entire help desk, all the staff there have access to this, but I can choose by groups and policies and types of administrators very granularly to every single thing that you can think of, which group of users have what power. So only the vice president of IT, and I don't think he knows he has the power, myself and my staff can actually recover other people's files. We're the only ones. So that gets away from people saying, but what about my research is my own, I don't want other people to see mine. There's three people on the entire campus who have the power to recover your files, and we don't do it. So that's pretty safe. But the help desk then can see status of backups. They can grant more quota, right? Everything is policy-based. So if a user all of a sudden has a lot of really important stuff and they've run out of quota, every day there's an email report that goes to the help desk. The night shift or weekend sometimes look at that and bump people's quotas up or trim them down. Something that most other things don't have, the bottom bullet there, really key, return unused. And I do that sometimes near the end of a month. Certainly at the end of a fiscal year when I do some trimming of unused resources, once I've bought licenses or space and I look at my usage and I go, wow, you know, people are using less, or I have fewer faculty and they're not using those license keys anymore, I just click on which ones out of which categories I want to return and I say return, and I never get billed for them again. So, you know, again, comparing that to projecting how many I need, I have to buy them in advance, it's a great tool. So going forward, the cloud comes of age. Whose cloud gets which data? All of you have heard some hype about clouds by now, no? If not, before you came here, hopefully that by now you've heard about the cloud. So whose cloud gets which data? And again, these are going forward, the things I'm forecasting. They're going to become issues for USF or all of you in this topic. Private cloud, great thing. It gives you high control, but of course it's going to be at a high cost. Public cloud, really low cost. If you go out there right now and you're buying in bulk or you have a consortium to buy from, really, really low cost. A hybrid cloud, which in USF's case would be our ability to collaborate and cooperate. We're one of 26 or 27 Association of Jesuit Colleges and Universities in the United States. We all have data centers. We all have hopefully big pipes, never big enough, right? So how we can collaborate together to take advantage of each other's resources, or the fact that your institution is somewhere else, you can park your data, gives you kind of the best of both of these. Greater control, it's in the hands of someone you trust, hopefully, and lower cost because you're not paying a service provider. You're not paying Amazon, Rackspace, someone like that. server backups move to the cloud. There's 44 departmental level servers right now at USF using Mosey, and the sysadmins of those were originally the ones who were kind of laughing and not willing to even put their own data there. Now every time that there's, especially with the advent of virtualization, it's kind of hard for people to wrap around their minds, like, where does the data live when it's on a shared data set that's on the SAN, but this is a server and my data is my data. So for them it's really easy. They slap the Mosey Pro client on, configure it, and they don't know. It works. So we're going to have more of that. More space per device. The server backups compared to end-user backups are shifting. By the way, end-user, we have some who have very light usage. It's required on all laptops and some desktops. You know, it's optional on desktops, but laptops of any type, it's required. Generally 2 to 5 gig per user, but the bigger users weigh in around 30 gig or more. There's some who exceed that on occasion, and that's usually a dean or someone who we just know, institutional researcher, someone who needs to carry their data with them all the time, and it's very important, so we go ahead and give them a big quota. But servers, a lot of them are, 10, 20 gig But it's really important data that we can snapshot up to, you know, every other hour and pull back quickly. Faster backup and recovery time, limited pipe for servers as you start having 100 gig backup sets. One of the, you know, things that we're going to have to address is, wow, how do I pull 100 gig quick out of the cloud for my recovery time objectives for applications for servers? So again, some of the solutions coming in down here would be the three-tier model using local aggregation. And you're going to see and read more about this. If you didn't yesterday, there was one particular announcement, but there's going to be many about people collaborating together with service providers, mixing private, public, and hybrid clouds with the ability to do faster backup and recovery using three-tier model. In that three-tier model, the concept is the end users have their data on their devices, the primary storage device that's doing some quality or policy level or deduplication may be local to the LAN, so it's a faster speed, and then you're kind of trickling on bandwidth later that night when there's not peak usage, things like that. You can kind of even out your bandwidth utilization without having to worry about things. Makes it quicker, too, when you're trying to do server or VM recoveries, rollbacks, if it's a LAN speed than it is pulling it out of the cloud. And the virtualization impact, again, in here is both from the top down, the bottom up. Changing configuration and storage backup model for this server, laptop, and thin client. We're starting to put out thin clients more and more. Well, where does that data reside? Well, it's in the, you know, in the central infrastructure, but now we have to back up that data. So no matter where the data goes, it's like whack-a-mole. You know, we just move the costs and the data somewhere else, but no matter where it goes, it needs to be recoverable. And, of course, there's a greater opportunity for storage reduction with deduping with virtualization, because if you can look or dedupe across all of your sets, there's huge economies of scale there that normally you wouldn't be able to do if you didn't have some value add. Your data would just keep growing exponentially. Again, different levels. Our enterprise data, for the most part, okay, that's not on MOSI. That's not a departmental file server. It's not a desktop laptop. That's high availability. We have a hot site at a sister school, transaction records, Oracle Data Guard, things like that. That your crown jewels you're always going to pay a premium for. Primary storage, secondary backup, that's where you should be paying a premium for. But non-critical, high-value data, as I said, now at USF is starting to use the backup solution that we're using primarily for desktops and laptops, and it's working really very well. Between 1 and 8 times a day that you can do snapshots or backups. Again, the number of devices that we're at. And the last item, which doesn't cost me at all, is student and adjunct. So if you recall, I opened this presentation with back up your files. So one of the things that we do is we have a portal and a relationship with MOSI, but I think it's there for a lot of other people. There's about 400 devices, and these tend to be about 300 student, 100 adjunct. Those are personal computers that have 2 gig free, right? Which, you know, if you're an average light user, an adjunct, your institutional data, you probably don't have that much anyhow, but they have to provide their own computers, right? At least in our case. So they get MOSI for free. They can put it on their computer, Mac, PC, whatever it is. And about 100 of those 400 devices have purchased the unlimited, but those are people who, students or whatever, have just put on their credit card and they decided they want to have unlimited backup. So, and that's good for me because that's 400 devices. I'm not paying those backup costs for those people. But again, you know, the adoption is certainly there, and this is a less than 3-year period. So I'm fairly happy about that. So that ends my portion of, like, lecturing to you. I'm sure you have some questions. Yes, sir.
So how is the payment happening? Are you organized the contract, and every time a department wants to come in, they go through you, or they go directly to MOSI, and all the
okay. Sure. So great question about billing. You know, how does it happen? Who gets bills? How do you set it up if a department wants in? One of the things that we did, there's a lot of flexibility in how MOSI can do it. They can set you up, whoever the lead is, as like a reseller, basically, and then you're just reselling internally to your departments. At USF, I just wanted this to be simple and painless because it wasn't supposed to be mine. Remember, the central systems infrastructure people, it was their project, but it was the Board of Trustees and risk and general counsel who said, this is not going to work at these prices. So I came up with a solution, and I'm still living with it. And that is that it actually goes on my university purchase card once a month. It actually, my limit, it is okay. It fits on there, so it's not a huge amount of money. And I pay for everyone. However, when you make user groups, and there's Active Directory integration, by the way, that you can build in there as well. By Active Directory integration, I already know the department or the unit they're in, and our FOPS or our fund organization application, or you know, our chart of accounts is in there. So actually, everyone in their department ends up in the right OU, they're in the right group, and the groups have a FOPE code, which I don't bill them back for, but I built it that way day one, in case someday I get squeezed really tight, I can always go back to groups and bill them back. But right now, I get a little statement, you know, an email once a month saying, your credit card's been charged, thank you. The billing interface is really detailed. I can see per client, per gig, per user, per machine, where it went, but no one's asked in nearly 3 years. So in our case, it's really very simple. And you could break that out into multiples, or in my case, I just have it go to one credit card.
Did you
separately? No, in that case, what you do is you set them up in the beginning that way where my client groups are individual clients. And again, as an administrator, what I would want to do, being the control freak, the security officer, is I would be have the master account rules, and then I make sub-administrators. And then that way, when that administrator for the School of Education is on vacation for 3 or 4 weeks or the school is closed and something happened, I can still have access to it. So I want to grab some other questions. Yes? The gentleman with the jacket?
For an off-campus backup, additional internet
bandwidth? No additional bandwidth. And again, one of the great things that we found through testing is it's only doing bit-level changes to files after the initial backup. The initial backup may take time, but you know, no matter what you do, it's going to take time. For most users, they still get more bandwidth on campus than at home, so we tried to get them to do their initial backup here. But they can close the laptop 1,000 times, open it, close it. It's completely transparent to them. It just starts running, and it'll rebuild the backup where it left off. We have the ability to throttle in the console the amount of bandwidth, make the throttling invisible to the user, and even set time of day throttling. So time of day, day of week, maximum bit rate per, and it's crazy, of which I don't bother setting. Right now we cap every IP address on campus at 4 meg only because, like everyone else, there's always, you know, that 1% of your population that are sucking down 95% of your bandwidth. But outside of that, there's no caps. Yes? Their Mosey Pro account user, so their username is their institutional email address. And that's the way that they're all made and built to keep it more easily attached with Active Directory and stuff too. It's a lot easier for our help desk when we have a problem, we can just type in the username and we can find them. Or even, I mean, their whole name. At the registration process on the client, they can add their own phone extension, first name, last name, and you can just type a few letters of the last name, and it'll magically find all the people who match that. So that's fairly easy. And the second part was, they choose their own passwords. And one of the reasons we did that, that was a choice that I made earlier, again, was for the adoption of people saying, hey, wait, privacy. I don't want anyone having a copy of my data. So again, that there's only three people in the institution who can retrieve the data other than the user. And I don't know your password. You know, I'd love to help you. I can show you the self-service password reset, but you can't blame me that I went and I got your stuff because, you know, if you're that paranoid, pick your own password. And that really helped a lot of people. The vast majority are so comfortable they want it to be the same password because no one wants multiple passwords. Yes, sir?
So
the client isn't encrypting the hard drive. We are hard drive encryption we use FileVault for Macs, although we're looking at the Sophos product for that. They're coming out with one for Mac. But it's now owned by Sophos, but it was Udemako, the whole disk encryption. called Safeguard Easy. Now we have the enterprise version because it is being integrated with our antivirus, endpoint protection into one pane of glass. It's really nice to see everything. One fewer window open on my desktop. So we do that separately. However, the encryption of the files before they leave the computer is done by the client. And to answer someone else's question, because I know it's coming, whose key is it and what's the key strength? Every key is individual to the end user's machines. They're generated at the time the client's installed, and the key pair are also kept nice and safe in the cloud in multiple data centers. So if that helps. I mean, one of the options is you can let people choose their own passphrase. But, you know, that's like people, me allowing people to choose their own password, it'd be ABC, 123. So it's easier that way. Yes?
Dina said we can access this faculty member's stored data. How do we do that?
Pardon me? Then they make a service request like anything else through the IT organization. You backup, storage, recovery, all those things are there. Because it's not just the dean. The question was, the dean says we need access to his faculty members' data. Well, then they let me know. And that's fairly easy. If it's in a case where, and this has honestly happened, where you know, a faculty member has passed away from a heart attack, you know, during finals week on the basketball court, and it was my professor. One of the grades that someone wasn't going to get would have been me unless someone can get that data and get it fairly quickly. And we're a small enough institution that, you know, I kind of know who's asking and why. So that's a kind of a no-brainer of saying, oh, sure, where do you want it? But it hasn't been an issue. The other one is general counsel. And, you know, quite honestly, you have issues sometimes with an employee. So general counsel or HR has to make their case to me of saying, okay, this is kind of extraordinary, but we think something's illegal or not right going on here, and the employee refuses to bring the laptop in, and we think there is a crime committed or something. That I use my judgment on that. Yes? In the back there, sir. It mix and match because, you know, we have the different colleges, and to try and make one institution-wide policy, it's like hurting, it's worse than hurting cats. So our biggest school, Arts and Sciences, still has home directories that every user mounts on their central infrastructure, whatever. However, their end-user devices come from IT, and so the IT policy is I have this system that's grabbing those files for you, regardless of what your school is doing, because, again, general counsel or HR may have an issue, and I can't depend on a system administrator in chemistry, in Arts and Sciences, that they reasonably backed up that person's computer in time. Plus, that system administrator is not who the faculty member is going to go to crying when their laptop gets run over by a truck and needs to be replaced. It's central IT. So as a great thing, you know, and my help desk is really close by, they have the console. When they rebuild and reimage a computer, if they need the data, right, they tell me or my staff as they go grab a new one out of inventory while they're imaging the computer, they tell us. In that time, we're pulling a full restore down and getting it ready so that by the time it's imaged and patched and ready to go to the faculty member, we have their data, and we just put their data on it and give it back to them. And that's been, you know, honestly, like hair raising on my arms and neck experience of how many people are almost ready to just cry and lose it when they think that everything is gone. And within 4 or 5 hours, they get a brand new computer and all their data's on it with the icons in the same place. I can't tell you. It's like, oh, thank you, thank you, thank you. And I always remember who those people are so that if someday in the future there's an objection and say, oh, do you know Professor so-and-so? I think you two should talk because she'll tell you how it saved her bacon. In the beginning, I was saving up, you know, whose bacon was saved, and now it's completely adopted. Two more questions, I think. Yes, young lady? No, almost. So one of the things that it's dying with, more by economic need and audit than by policy, really, or my doing, is end-user systems that are like departmental, separate servers. They're dying off, and we're virtualizing. Now we're going to a VMware environment, and we have some Citrix as well. But as those older ones die that we're going to a backup exec server that's on a tape archive. We use a local company called Coravan. I mean, the tapes never really get very far away. We move it to the other side of San Francisco, you know, so a lot of good that's really going to do. But when you look at the cost of that, that's what's making the people who run that central systems infrastructure, those sysadmins who have put the 44 here, are like, oh, this is a no-brainer. I don't have to configure on the backup server. I don't have to put a backup client. I don't have to rotate tapes. I don't have to send them off. So it's dying. I'd say about another year and a half, and tape will be completely gone. Yes, sir.
In terms of pricing terms, can you just take the general offering for MultiPro, or did you negotiate something specific?
I mean, at the time, we were one of the larger ones, so it was kind of negotiated pricing in the beginning, although now it's fairly common. I think it's probably published. It's a volume discount kind of a thing. So, you know, if you buy a lot, you're going to be in the usual range of what you know you can probably get vendors, right? The same thing whether you're buying hardware or anything else, you know, okay, a 10% discount isn't very much if you're buying a lot. If you're buying a lot from a vendor, you probably know what your discount level should be for volume purchases. It's about the same. So as we've grown, that's one of the other things of why sometimes what the actual cost savings are changes in the way of prediction, because I don't know. But as I start growing more, the good news is I get a per unit bigger discount by another 5%, and that's now applied over 1,000 clients and 7 to 10 terabytes of data or so. Well, one more question? Anyone want to have it? Yes, in the back.
Does what you offer like sharing files or anything like that?
At this point, they don't, but that's something that, again, in those kind of futures that I expect is they have a home offering and they have an offering that's private branded through Comcast and some of the other big carriers, I think Time Warner and a few others, that allow them to do that. So their home offerings allow them to, like, automatically back up files and, you know, pictures and stuff, and then through a web interface share it with people. Backing up mobile devices. So since it's already in the family somewhere, I wouldn't be surprised that that will come. And I think that that's going to be driven by more and more people have things like an iPad and iPhones and Android devices that are having more and more data on them. And that'll become a future issue as well of how we back those up, which is going to be, it's crazy because everyone has their own service plan. But as of right now, they don't. Some other offerings are starting to play in that field. That's something I expect to come. And that, again, it was the ability for some users to be able to do a content distribution or sharing of something that they already have with other users to be able to actually market and say, share this with whomever, kind of like through SharePoint. Okay, well, thank you all very much for coming. Please eat the candy in the back of the room. I do not want to have all that chocolate.